Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to this Thursday morning edition of the Roundtable. Very nice to have you with us and to have you tuning in on a beautiful day, a beautiful Thursday. And it's just great to have you here. We have a lot to talk about. We'll do so with some wonderful people. And you're included in that list of wonderful people because you can write us a note and be a part of the program. All you have to do is write to us at panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org. We would love to hear from you as always. Let me introduce the group to you and then we will get started. We'll get started with our long list of topics to discuss this morning. Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, Alan. How are you, dear friend?
Yeah, and you, dear friend, I took my walk this morning and it was lovely and I just had a light little covering on and boy, I remember all of those days when I had to have four and five layers on in order to get it done. And
it was like a really windbreaker today? Was it a windbreaker day?
Yeah, sort of. It was a WAMC schmata.
Okay, a schmata. Yes.
A WAMC schmata.
Schmata.
Schmata. Yes. It means a covering, with a WAMC signature on it. So if a bear comes up to me, he'll say, oh, you listen to WAMC, I'll leave you alone.
By the way, if you would like your very own WAMC schmata, all you would have to do is go to WAMC.org and help out with a lockbox, which is now getting ready to be opened and primed for delivery. And it's in the drop-down menu. And there's also lots of other stuff there, but it all begins on Monday as Alan and I will be pleading for you to get a schmata.
That was really smooth.
Thank you very much, Fran. I appreciate that. Yeah. Go ahead. We didn't even plan it, but go ahead, Alan.
Yeah. So that is important because no money, no station. There's no question. And everybody knows that. I'm not telling anybody anything they don't know. You all know it. You know it, and you've been wonderful. And I expect that the same thing's going to happen again now.
Absolutely. Well, we look forward to that. That'll be Monday morning and very exciting stuff. So we'll bring you up to date on that next week. But good morning, Alan. Very nice to have you here. We also welcome Fran Berman, Edward Hamilton Distinguished Professor of Computer Science at RPI and Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Good morning, Fran. How are you?
I am good. For all of you who are not in Troy, we are in the process of becoming a movie set. So if you are hearing noises while I am speaking, it is us becoming almost famous.
Hollywood on the Hudson.
Hollywood on the Hudson. There you go.
Well, good for you. Do you know what the movie is? Do you know who's starring? Are there any cool people?
Well, I know a little, I know as much as anybody. It's a series called The Gilded Age, and it's by the guy who wrote Downton Abbey. And
Julian
apparently,
Barnes.
With only slight changes, we look about as close to The Gilded Age as they found. So I guess they'll be filming here over the next month, and all of a sudden, already storefronts and stuff like that are being transformed. It's interesting.
Well, if you see anybody cool, bring them up to your house and put them on the line. We'd love to talk to them.
Well, I'm not in the WAMC studio, so I can't see anybody cool.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, look out the window. But it's good to have you here, Fran. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Albany's Chief City Auditor, Dorsey Pleers, is here. Good morning, Dorsey. Great pleasure to have you back in the program.
Good morning, and a great pleasure to be back with you all today.
Thank you very much. Been a little while since we've talked to Vera, Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly. Good morning, Vera. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm good. I'm in the last week of finishing up the semester. I have exams coming and over 300 pages of research papers this weekend, so you can imagine the mood I'll be in soon.
You know, Vera, that sounds awful.
It does.
Sounds really, really awful.
That is awful.
Yeah, it is awful. I have to say, I saw a lovely picture of you and some of your students on Facebook. You and they all look delighted. And I don't know whether that's just the mood of the room or because you're ending the semester.
Oh, we're ending the semester and we were allowed to take our masks off. So we were actually recognizing each other on campus instead of going staring at each other going like, who are you? Do I know you?
Yeah, well, that's very nice. Well, Vera, it's great to have you. I know we, because of Earth Day and stuff, we got bumped around, and I'm very pleased that you're back with us and good to have you on the program. Dr. Carolina Gonzalez is with us, Assistant Dean in the College of Education and Human Services at Montclair State University. Carolina, thank you so much for being with us. I believe this is your second time on the program. We are glad that it must have gone fairly well the first time that you accepted our invitation to come back.
I am so honored to be back. Thank you so much for welcoming me. Vera just summarized what my semester looks like right now, or what my feelings are right now with the end of the semester's hectic nature. But the silver lining is that it's commencement season, so people are graduating, and it's happy times as well.
Yeah, well, that's good. Well, congratulations to all the graduates and to all those wonderful professors who help them in their pursuits. And we move forward today on our topics, and I thank the professors for taking time out of their busy schedules to be with us this morning. It's very nice to have you all here. All right, let's begin. I got everybody, right? Okay, I think I remembered everybody.
But by the way, Joe, I just want to point out for all of the people who are professors, having done that for 40 years myself, and I remember.
Don't you miss it?
I miss the teaching,
yeah,
but I don't miss the marking. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So I do have a way of doing it. Chartok's rules of doing it. You take the 50 papers, you put them in front of you, and then you turn them over each one, and then you read it. Now, here's the rule. You cannot stop in the middle of marking a paper, because if you do, then then you have to go back to the beginning. So rule number one is you can't stop in the middle. And rule number two is as soon as you finish the first one, you have to pick up the second one, applying rule number one and two. Don't you see?
Yes, until you're done. That's right. I agree with you. Yeah, that's the way to do it. I think when I first started, and obviously you all are much more advanced as this, I am but just an adjunct. But when you go through the papers, it's fascinating to me, because I would say, all right, well, I'll do five now. And then I realized how long that takes. And I was like, well, I'm here, I might as well just do the rest, because if I don't, I may never get to them again.
Yeah, but the key is you don't want to get to the point where you're grumpy. So the next thing you're meaner. You don't want to do that. You want to be equally
it's a good point.
Whatever to all the students.
Which brings up
You tell me that 40 years later.
Which you didn't ask me before, Alan.
Which brings me to the question, which is, Fran, you get grumpy?
Oh, I do get grumpy.
You seem like
I try not to be grumpy on the
grumpy
radio.
Grumpy person,
out of respect
I know.
And admiration for all of you.
Well, thank you very much. All right, let's get started. Welcome all. And again, panel at WAMC.org is how you get in on the fun. Panel at WAMC.org. Got a couple tech stories for you, friend. Were you impressed that I included those?
I know. Thank you so
much.
Very,
you're very welcome. So let's begin with the there's a lot to talk about, and I want to get to Israel, and I want to get to some of those issues. But let's begin with the January 6th commission, and that is what's going on. And the strangest there. So the House has passed a bill to create a commission to investigate the January 6th attack on the Capitol, but its chances in the Senate are dim. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader, the Republican from Kentucky, came out against the bill earlier in the day yesterday. This after Kevin McCarthy, the House Minority Leader, came out said he was also against the measure. He said he opposes the legislation because it is a slanted and unbalanced proposal. A day after he said his members were open to voting for the plan but needed a chance to read the quote-unquote fine print. In between those comments, former President Donald Trump released a statement Tuesday evening slamming the bill and decrying it as a Democrat trap while urging McConnell and other GOP leaders to start listening. It's not at all clear what new facts or additional investigation yet another commission could actually lay on top of existing efforts by law enforcement and Congress, McConnell said on the floor Wednesday. Several question marks remain about the attack, however, including to what degree it was coordinated, as well as details about what Trump was doing while it was taking place. The House vote, just for those of you keeping track at home, 252 to 175. Dr. Alan Chartok, your thoughts.
Well, we do know that it's probably going to be doomed in the United States Senate, where the anthropologists have found evidence of, human beings without spines. Hmm. So what can I tell you except that it could be good news for the Democrats, because the Democrats say, well, we tried to do this. We offered similar numbers of Republicans and Democrats on the commission. All of America saw what was going on. Your lies about how it was just a bunch of people coming in to look at the Capitol the way all tourists look at the Capitol. Yeah, with the windows being busted and all of the rest.
Right.
It is the big lie over and over and over again. You just better believe that that's what's happening. I think the Democrats are going to win, maybe not among the Republicans, but they're going to win among the neutrals, all of whom saw it.
Vera Carius Kelly, do you think that the concern here among the Republicans is that they'll find out more about just how bad this was?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is an embarrassing chapter for the Republican Party, and I find it so interesting that the whole split within the Republican Party is becoming wider and wider. It's been brewing for a while, and the fact that the Republican House Homeland Security Committee supported this effort in investigation into the January 6th events. Also shows that there is a growing separation between Republicans interested in fully disclosing and showing more transparency towards who was involved in organizing these events and to what extent the former president and members, perhaps, of the Republican Senate senators participated in these events or coordinated in parts of these events. So this is a very interesting moment for the Republican Party. I think it will show over time that we will either see a split to the extent of a separating out of members of the Republican Party to form a new party, or it will sink the Republican Party if it sticks overwhelmingly with the big lie approach to what took place with the election and the January 6th events.
Carolina.
Yes, I mean, I think to Vera's point, it if anything, this tells us that Trump is very much present in the Republican Party and influencing it as well. And there's clearly continued loyalty to him. I mean, Mitch McConnell attributed the attacks on January 6th to Trump's leadership. And now he seems to be backtracking and softening his tone. So as my colleague mentioned, the Republican Party is almost in an identity crisis, right? And is trying to reconcile who they are and who they want to be with what they want to accomplish. And they don't know necessarily how to get there. And at the moment, they're thinking Trump is the way to do it. Maybe it's because of money coming in. Maybe it's because of influence. But right now, I think that the American public is confused. Right? I don't know if they know what exactly does the Republican Party stand for and stand behind.
It's a very interesting point of that idea of an identity crisis. Fran Berman.
I'm unmuting, although I'm not sure that the politics in the Gilded Age was any different from now. I don't know. I mean, you all know that, you know, my heart belongs to the public interest. And so, you know, I see something like this where, you know, all of the strategies, all of them, have to do with politics. You know, they have to do with, you know, have we positioned ourselves and do we want to be, you know, on the record for a vote you know, there was some suggestions about kitchen sinking, investigation of protests at racial justice rallies. It's just, you know, all of this is just political strategizing. And really what the commission ought to be about is to figure out, you know, what happened, how did it happen, how can we prevent it from happening again, how can we protect the people we elect as our public servants, no matter what party they're in, you know, the sort of unpolitical, reasonable things like that. And I don't know, you know, I look at something like this and, you know, my heart sinks a little bit lower because there's so many opportunities to see my right. heart sink for, you know, all of these very, very partisan perspectives.
Dorsey, I want to get, and Alan, I want to get to your thoughts sure. on this too. We do have to take a break, so we'll do that. And when we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your thoughts on this. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we'll continue. We have a wonderful panel this morning. Alan Chartok, Dorsey Appleers, Fran Berman, Vera Carius Kelly, and Carolina Gonzalez. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. First, we will go to news from the BBC, and then we'll be back with more discussion right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you all with us. Before we went to break, we're talking about this issue of the January 6th commission, and we've been going through all of our panelists to get their thoughts. And we are, last but certainly not least, up to Dorsey Appleers. Dorsey, good morning, and what do you think?
Good morning, Joe. So just to add what has already been mentioned, you know, I think it's easy to lose sight of the real issue here because there's so many layers to this. And from my perspective, you know, the crux of the issue here is politics, of course, the pursuit of power, and white supremacy. And I think that our country's history of just turning a blind eye to issues related to race, it is being perpetuated here. And so you have casualties of war, the Capitol Police, the staff of the legislators who were there that day, the legislators. And so the crux of the problem for me, or the crux of the issue for me, is really politics, yeah. pursuit of power, and white supremacy. And as Catalina mentioned, Vera mentioned, these notions of all eyes on our democracy, this identity crisis of the Republican Party, I think it's really an identity crisis of our country. And for the average person looking in, you know, whether it's the Republicans choosing not to vote for this commission, people are asking themselves, can I trust, can I have faith in this democracy? And the way things look, it looks very dim at the moment.
It does look dim, doesn't it, Alan?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's dim, but not. I mean, let's face it. Joe Biden won the presidency by, what, 7 or 8 million votes
Correct.
Over his opponent. And one just says, all right, has that coalition that came together to elect him dissipated, or has it grown stronger? Now, I think one could make an argument either way, but I think it's actually grown stronger. For example, his numbers are in the high 50s and mid 50s and high 50s. And the other guy keeps saying he's going to run for president and who is... has been indicated is a racist, is in the 30s. So the Republicans are scared to death for their individual offices, worrying about this president turning on them. He called in a play and said, we don't want this commission. We're not going to have this commission. And everybody said yes, and they did exactly what they were told. So they could feel good about it, but the American people and the independents in the middle will not feel good about it.
Do you think Vera, let's go to you on this, but do you think that we will see what impact, I mean, obviously one of the questions, the big questions, is what impact this will have on the House elections just next year, which seems impossible to think of, but yes, indeed, it's, a year plus away, and everybody's already lining up of what impact that will have. Vera?
Sorry, I couldn't.
That's okay. I know everyone's on mute, and then, which is very nice, but then we have to remember
to
unmute.
I actually could not hear you for a second, so
oh,
I apologize.
You missed my brilliant question.
I did.
No, it wasn't all that brilliant. My question.
It was a great question. Very important.
Thank you.
It was amazing.
So, what do you think? Is what I asked.
Yeah, I'm in trouble.
My question was: when you look at what impact do you think this will have on the congressional elections in just over a year from now?
It's a great question.
I mean, I'm not clear that all these finer, moments and the gamesmanship and all these decisions, we can already judge what the impact will be, because I think we have to look at the compounding effect. What voters pay more attention to is their pocketbook issues. The fact if in fact we don't have additional COVID problems in the fall, what travel looks like. I mean, there's so many other factors, I think, that matter more to the vast majority to Americans. The only exception I would make to that are these constant restrictions to voting right issues. Those are issues that people are deeply concerned about and paying close attention to. This kind of voting right now that we see on what we will likely see in the Senate on the January 6th commission, that is almost expected for the current state of the Republicans. So nobody will really be that surprised. What will matter is how it affects communities and individual voters' lives, I think. Once we see real impact in terms of economic recovery, opening of schools, opportunities for young people, unemployment rates, those are the compounding factors, in my view, that will determine the outcome of the next election or the congressional elections.
Carolina?
If I may, Vera, just back to you for one second here. Mm. You're a brilliant political scientist. I know that. And I wanted to ask you whether or not, in your mind, there are so many other factors in terms of answering Joe's very good question. In other words, districts all around the country, because more legislatures are Republican than Democrat, have been gerrymandered like crazy. Mm-hmm. So you may have a Biden with a 50-something percent approval rating or a 60% approval rating, and you compare that with Trump's 30%, well, you would think there'd be no problem in terms of the Congress staying blue. But because of the machinations of the gerrymander and everything else, that's by no means assured, right?
You're correct. Absolutely. I mean, this is exactly it. I mean, the real struggles are happening on the grassroots level, township by township, county by county, electoral district by electoral district. This is where all of the, voters will have to pay very close attention to what is developing. And I have to say, from my limited perspective here in the Albany area in upstate New York, I'm not sure this is happening. I think people are not paying close enough, voters are not paying close enough attention in general to what is happening. They're so focused on their personal recovery and return to a sense of normalcy that many, many of my students, my neighbors, even community members I chat with at farmers markets, they're tuned out. They're exhausted.
Yeah. Carolina?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I agree with you in terms of voters not paying attention, especially to, the voter suppression efforts that have been ramped up.
mostly because we just went through an election that really took all of our energy, right? Like there was so much, it was very divisive, but there was also a lot of emotional labor that went into it for a lot of people for many reasons. We were in the middle of the pandemic and still are, but hopefully getting out of it soon. So, you know, to think about the midterm election coming up is way back in people's minds. I think that the impact is, you know, we've seen already the impact of what has been going on with grassroots efforts continuing to ramp up, the way that Stacey Abrams rallied voters in Georgia and across the country as well. So I think we'll see a lot more of that, and that's how folks are being informed for the folks who it's impacting. And I only with those efforts, I believe that we will see a little bit more engagement in the elections, because we see how important it is to not only vote in a primary, but, you know, vote across the board whenever there is an election coming up.
You know, I really agree with that, because I think that when you think about, are you voting for this commission or anything else, you're trying to optimize for playing the game. But I think, as Vera and Alan said, when you suppress voting, when you're really changing the game itself, and you're changing the game itself so that, individuals, groups, participation doesn't matter. And not only is that important for us as citizens, but, you know, our voices have so little influence in so many ways. There's so much money in the system. There's so much power to big corporations in the system. There's so many important influences in the system that our real influence is deciding who's in the system, at least to some extent. And when we can't do that in a full way, we're really in trouble. And so I agree with that. You know, I agree with, you know, there's very little that's more important than ensuring that, you know, however you play the game, it's a fair game. It's a game where everybody can participate in whatever ways the system allows us to.
Dorsey.
And if I could just add to that, I think that people are paying attention in a different way. So while people historically are concerned about the everyday issues, the economy, being able to put food on their table, we don't have a monolithic voting base on either side. And there are some extremes on both sides in terms of who is paying attention to some of these core battle for the soul of our nation issues, like race relations, police reform, abortion. And so on one side, those who stormed the Capitol, the issues that they are paying attention to, yes, it's the economy, but there are some other issues. And so going back to the conversation about this vote, not only are Republicans scared of Donald Trump, but they are also scared of that base, because they know now the power of that base, those individuals who stormed the Capitol, and not wanting to lose the votes of those individuals. And so this is a very different season that this country is in, and you have more people paying attention to those issues that really make or break us as a society and where you stand on those issues.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a lot of letters on this, so I'll get to those when we come back, and then we'll move on to other topics. Great panel this morning, wonderful group, and you can join us all. Alan Chartok, Dorsey Appliers, Fran Berman, Vera Carius-Kelly, and Carolina Gonzalez, and we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this morning. As I said, we have a wonderful group of of panelists, and we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. All right, here are the letters we have. Mark says, "We Democrats are the ones who misunderstand what's happening. It's only the Republican leadership that is in an identity crisis, not the voters. The 73 million people who all voted for Trump know exactly what they stand for. They want Donald Trump. They want what Donald Trump is selling them, and that is fascist control of the future of this country. The handwriting is on the wall." Who agrees with Mark? All right. No one agrees
okay,
with Mark.
Okay, so can I just say that there's one thing I would bring up as well, the importance of messaging apps and social media access and misinformation campaigns. So I'm not sure all the voters in that supposed block know exactly what they want, but they've been told what to watch out for and what they need to want if they want to survive, they think, their lifestyle or an imaginary future that they need to protect. So I think there's a lot of propaganda and manipulation out there as well. So I'm not that convinced that all these millions of people know exactly what they want, but they have been told to believe certain narratives.
Alan, any thoughts on that? All right.
Yes. Good. Here's Alan.
Hello, Alan.
I got a bad back, and I got to bend over
to
the machine
I
to
know.
Turn the thing on.
We need to get you a gooseneck, the thing that comes over and goes right in front.
I think I have something like that, but I don't know.
All right.
So anyway.
Or maybe just hire an assistant to hold the mic, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Now, what was the question?
The question was this letter that we got that basically, yes. You know, that the 73 million people who voted for Trump are buying what he is selling, and the handwriting is on the wall, and democracy is doomed.
I don't think it's doomed, but I do agree that what Trump is selling is exactly what Mark said. So do I think democracy is doomed? No. Is it possible it's going to be doomed based on what we have seen? You know, either people stand up and they say, we are not buying this, which is what happened in the last election, or Trump wins, which is what happened in the election before. Trump is a would-be fascist. I have no question that Mark is right about that. That's the case. So the question is, can you get your voters out? Can you coalesce? Do you stick together if you oppose that kind of fascist input, or do you not? And that's where American politics is right now. We have a white majority, former white majority in this country, which is desperately trying to hold on to power. And that's what drives everybody into that 73 million. No question about it. I disagree with Vera. I think it was Vera who said, because I think basically, those people know exactly somewhere in their brains that this is either going to be an American democracy, which includes everybody, or not. So what do? You say, okay, but you can't vote. We're taking away your voting station from you. We're going to change the voting laws so that you don't count. We're going to recount, and we're going to have the big lie over and over and over and over again that says that this was a stolen election, and to give some solace to the people who are believing that crap, because that's what it is. And so that's my reaction.
All right, let's go to this letter from Julius, who says the key is Kevin McCarthy's statement about including the Black Lives Matter protests in the investigation. We are still fighting the Civil War and white supremacy, plain and simple. Dorsey, your thoughts on that?
That's accurate from where I sit.
Right.
I just think that we love a good distraction, and so for those who are saying that this legislation is partisan, and so an attempt to make it bipartisan would be to launch a more comprehensive investigation, I think it is another tactic to just distract us from the real issues here.
Carolina?
Dorsey is so right.
Oh, Fran, go ahead, and then I'll go to Carolina.
Well, I'm so sorry. Carolina, do you want to go ahead?
No, go ahead, Fran. You got the floor.
Well, I was just going to say, Dorsey is so right, because these are two different beasts. The Capitol insurrection was a violent attack on the Capitol and its occupants. And Black Lives protests, or any kind of protests, are ways to make your voice heard in an acceptable way, in a way that we want in the United States. These are just two different beasts.
Carolina.
And the reality is the response to Black Lives Matter protests is completely different to the response that the January 6th insurrection received. I mean, there were hours before the National Guard was called to defend the Capitol. There was just a lack of communication, or an intentional lack of communication. So to put both of them in the same consider them to be the same, I think that's being done purposefully. I think it's being done to distract, as my colleagues said. But we also have to acknowledge that the kind of response that one received is not the same that the other one has received continuously. And the narrative also hasn't been the same. Just lately, there has been descriptors of the January 6th insurrection, as some folks have toned down the description of it and said, Well, you know, it looks like it any other day it would have looked like a tourist attraction, or it would have looked like people coming to see what's going on with the Capitol or with our nation. So you could see the narrative starting to change, or wanting a new narrative to be created to tone down the impact and tone down the criminality of the January 6th attack.
Vera?
And I wanted to just quickly say I fully agree with my colleague Carolina's assessment, because what we find is that, and that was, you know, my earlier point, that social media and, you know, certain platforms are being used to re-inscribe a narrative that has nothing to do with what took place, but it allows a portion of the population to insist on dominating the power structures in this country. And I think that's exactly also what Dorsey was saying. This is a power play to not record for this nation and for future generations what exactly took place and who were the perpetrator of the violence on January 6th, and to attempt to equalize Black Lives Matter protests and other legal protests that were involved in raising awareness and sort of create them falsely as an equal position to the attackers on January 6th at the Capitol, at the National Capitol. So this is what it's all about. It's rewriting history and creating a narrative that will shape voting behaviors in certain population groups for decades to come. It is an extremely dangerous development.
We have about 2 minutes before the top of the hour, and I'm going to ask a big question from Tristan. This is a message to the group. Good morning, panel. Is Trump really so intelligent and powerful that he can force Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, Ted Cruz, etc. to bow and kiss his tuchus? Or is Trump just the tool being wielded by someone else with deep pockets or compromising information? Alan.
Well, who knows? I mean, you know, clearly the people on top are trying to control things, and Trump represents their interests rather than broadening economic and philosophical democracy. We know that. Nevertheless, he's very powerful. If you take a look at his numbers, and then you take a look at Mitch McConnell's numbers, the last time I looked, and it's been a while, said Mitch McConnell was popular with 13% of the American public. You know, he's got to do what this guy says. This guy is a would-be fascist, as Mark said earlier. And it's very important to remember that he has these people under his thumb. It's that simple.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, a lively one, and we welcome you to join us, panel at WAMC.org. Let me just reintroduce the group. WAMC's Alan Shartok is here. Albany's chief city auditor, Dorsey Appleers, joins us. Edward Hamilton, distinguished professor of computer science at RPI and faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, Fran Berman, Siena College professor of comparative politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly, and Carolina Gonzalez, assistant dean in the College of Education and Human Services at Montclair State University. And again, we welcome your input, panel at WAMC.org. We got a ton of letters on the investigation into the January 6th insurrection. So let me go to those, and then we'll move on to other topics. I'll try to get to them as quickly as possible. Tom says, I'm really surprised we've not heard who committed the only homicide on January 6th at the Capitol. Ashley Babbitt was killed, shot on camera, but we do not know who the officer was, and I wonder why. Steve writes, and I'll just go through these, panel. If you want to jump in, please do. Steve writes, give the Republicans what they want and let Black Lives Matter events be investigated alongside January 6th. The comparison will clearly show which was mainly peaceful protest and which was plainly insurrection. Patrick writes, Democrats should go forward with separate investigative committees in the House and Senate into the January 6th attack on American democracy. Republican votes are not needed to set up committees to subpoena key witnesses or participate in the insurrection. Republicans should not be allowed to whitewash the most serious insurrection in U.S. history. Michael says, Black Lives Matter protests were marred by vandalism by some miscreants. The attack on the Capitol was an attempt to overthrow of the United States government. Two different scenarios. That's why an investigation by Congress would be necessary for the attack on the Capitol. Tom says, can the Attorney General get involved in calling for an inquiry into the January 6th attack without a congressional majority? Does anyone know the answer to that question?
Let there be no mistake about it. The Justice Department can do anything they want and always have. They can have a outright Republican control of the presidency, both houses. Who told the Justice Department that they can't do something? Now, obviously, Trump had a special relationship with his Justice Department, which I think at least Biden protested he does not. And he's going to let them do their own thing. But certainly, the Justice Department can do whatever it wants. The FBI is supposed to, for example, be a nonpartisan, down the middle group of people.
Anybody else on that? All right. Let's go to Deborah's letter. As a beyond middle-aged white female, I get so tired of white people equating white insurrectionists with Black Lives Matter. I tell them BLM is not characterized as a hate group by the FBI. The looks I get when they find out that I donate to BLM is precious. Give me a break. Give me a break to the Republicans in Congress. That is from Deborah. Vera?
No, I was just laughing because I thought,
enjoying the chuckle. Yes.
Yes, because I mean it's exactly what it is. It's a community civic national organization, and you can donate to it. So, I was just chuckling at that thought because, the Republicans are currently trying so hard to classify BLM as a terrorist group, which is obviously ridiculous.
Melinda writes, there's nothing confusing about the Republican Party. The leaders in the base just cannot let go of allegiance to Trump and will lie through their teeth to protect their beliefs and their actions. They don't want a joint commission because it will expose their own complicity in the January 6th insurrection on the Capitol and our democracy. Meanwhile, we go to this letter from Helen.
As well as individuals like McCarthy, who obviously would have to spill the beans about his relationship with Trump on all what was going on.
Right. And phone calls back and forth and all of that would have to come out into the open, assuming.
Yep.
Helen says, I'm not so sure that there are still 73 million voters that would vote for Trump and Republicans again.
Am I overly optimistic? Maybe, right?
Yes.
I've been wondering about that myself because, you know, it's pretty clear that these guys, well, it's clear to me from 50,000 feet away that these guys don't particularly like him as an individual, that it's all strategic and, you know, trying to figure out how to survive and thrive in their own careers. And so, and then with Trump being cut off from social media, by and large, you know, his mouthpiece isn't so much. So I wonder myself, you know, what kind of, what's the nature of his relationship with that base now? Did he energize a bunch of people that are, you know, in some sense going on themselves with his encouragement? You know, how much of it is really about him? And I've been wondering that myself, and I don't know the answer, but, you know, perhaps one of the other panelists or you know, our listeners do.
Dorsey, you were going to say?
No, I was simply saying, yes, I think that is the listener's optimism setting in. You know, we are not too far from the election and everything that led up to it. It was nail-biting, and even the results, many people are still very perplexed that Donald Trump still had the support that he did in terms of votes. And so, you know, as much as people think that Donald Trump is, you know, at this moment potentially powerless and doesn't have the influence, you know, you're talking about an individual who was able to energize a base that really operated under the grid because there were very few, even if you had the same views and ideologies, willing to stand tall on those. And here you have someone who is willing in the highest seats of government, the highest position, the most powerful position in the world, stand with individuals who promote white supremacy and other ideologies that Trump supporters and his base believe in. And so, you know, to have a vehicle, in this case, Trump being the tool, the vehicle to perpetuate a message, to help bring about an agenda that most leaders, even if they felt that way, wouldn't come out publicly and say certain things or do certain things. You know, he is the MVP for many of them, and so they will do anything to ensure that that tool, that vehicle has the most important seat in this world again. And so I personally wouldn't put anything past those who support Trump. They want to see him in power, period.
Carolina.
I was just going to add, I mean, Alan, you mentioned earlier, you know, Mitch McConnell's current numbers. I think you mentioned 13% or so. But Mitch McConnell was just recently, you know, campaigned and voted in once again, and won. I believe he won every county in Kentucky. So, you know, I can't lose sight that while the numbers in terms of approval ratings may be down, or that the 73 million voters may not all be there, I can't lose sight of what we have seen time and time again, where folks are displeased and just displeased with what's going on, and yet continue to seek out fuel from, you know, President Trump's base, despite them perhaps not aligning, their values not aligning, for the simple reason of wanting to remain in power and not speaking out either. And when speaking out, you know, you see Liz Cheney and what happened, right? They are stripped of their power, or they're outcasted, or whatever the repercussions may be. So I'm not sure that the numbers that were there before, we won't see that again the next time around.
No, I agree with you. And I also think that if you take a look at Mitch McConnell, the reason I said 13% is that his position vis-a-vis Trump is so poor. You know, he came out after the riot and he let Trump have it. And you haven't seen any of that lately, that's for sure. And that has to do with the internal polling and everything else that is being done in the Republican Party. You know, you mentioned Liz. I got to say very quickly, because I know Joe wants to do something else here. But you mentioned Cheney. Mm-hmm. She did her thing, and she was what we expect of great public servants. She'll go down in the history books. At this point, no matter what she had done before this, with some of which was terrible, she's going to go down in the history books as doing the right thing.
we'll forget the terrible stuff. You know, one thing, just a quick clarification on the McConnell numbers. McConnell, yes, won his last election, although, you know, initially it was closer. But it's the national numbers, when you look at his popularity nationally, that is just crushing. That even Republicans around the country, and I know that really doesn't matter because they don't have to vote for him. However, of the popularity that he has around the nation is really quite weak. All right, let's move on to other subjects, shall we? And in our half hour or so that we have left, and we'll get to other things here, I would like to talk a little bit about the Colonial Pipeline CEO saying that paying $4.4 million ransom was the right thing to do for our country. The Colonial chief executive Joseph Blunt said that he decided early to make the payment after the company was unsure how much of the system was at risk. You may remember that this was a major shutdown, a ransomware attack onto this very important pipeline that was offline for several days as a result. In an interview with the Wall Street Journal, the CEO said the decision to pay off a hacking group was the right thing to do. He acknowledged the payment was highly controversial since federal officials largely encourage companies not to incentivize further cyber attacks by compensating bad actors. But Blunt said the payment was necessary given the essential nature of the company's infrastructure. The pipeline supplies almost half of the East Coast's fuel, and almost immediately the stoppage set off waves of panic buying. He said it was also not immediately clear how far hackers had reached into Colonial's network and what other systems were at risk. Fran, I'm going to go to you first as our tech guru here, and what do you make of this story? Fran, are you there?
She's also having technical problems.
Yeah, I wonder if the Gilded Age has taken her over and they no longer have telephones. All right, well, we'll wait for Fran. Alan, your thoughts on the paying. We talked in this show about that ransom, but what we didn't know was how much it was for, and I don't know. For a big company, I don't know. Is that even a lot of money? I don't know.
No, it's not a lot of money. But the point is, it's a principle. And I don't think many Americans are saying, hey, wait a second now. All this does is encourage other people to do the same thing. And we don't want to encourage that. And this is just wrong. And yet they're doing it. And yet there are no lines outside of gas stations right now.
Right.
So do you pay the mortgage? Do you pay the blackmail or don't you? And clearly they are saying you do. And there is very little outcry about it. You know, I mean, I hate the idea that they're paying this terrible price. But for them, it's a piece of change. And, you know, the rest of us suckers will have to pay a couple of cents more at the gas pumps. And they don't care a bit about it. But so think about the implications.
It's an interesting point. Yes, Vera. Fran, are you there yet? Fran? Okay, go ahead, Vera.
I wanted just to make two fundamental points about this story.
Okay.
It's not as important to talk about the ransom as it is to think about how unprepared Colonial Pipeline as a company was to defend it's software from a Russian criminal enterprise that easily entered. This company did not do its due diligence in terms of protecting its stockholders and company employees and customers from these consequences, which is neglect in terms of updating its software, and the federal government critiqued Colonial Pipeline for it. And secondly, we need to reflect in this country on how our infrastructure is set up, because the fact alone that you could easily manipulate from the outside a major corporation's software and then, you know, basically disrupt energy supplies on the East Coast is quite shocking. So our infrastructure is too focused on being controlled by individual corporations without consulting with the federal government when it comes to national security-related resources. So those two points are significantly more important. What we should learn about this paid ransom is that in our infrastructure that is held by private companies that don't follow the most essential safety concerns when it comes to its software is shocking and needs to be addressed nationwide.
And Joe, for whatever it's worth, we heard from Fran, who says, can't get back in, unquote.
Yes, Fran is, we're in a technological purgatory, so we're working, our tech dudes are on it, and hopefully they will get Fran back very soon. Carolina, anything to say about this?
Yes, I mean, I think, so from what I understand, these ransomware groups who attack and organize are very sophisticated with their strategy and vet you know these private companies' financials in order to coordinate these attacks and even set a know what price to set as a ransom money. And so, you know, after collecting, then they dissolve and then reemerge again. And so, you know, it's interesting because of the cycle that the companies see themselves in when succumbing to the extortion that they experience, where, you know, they're extorted for some money, they don't want to pay, but then they either pay out in a very quiet manner or use a third party intermediary to do so. And so there's like a cycle of folks not knowing how much is paid out, when it is done, and then it just continues happening. And so I think that's part of where President Biden's attention is going in when he signed that recent executive order as part of the, cybersecurity within the Department of Homeland Security to investigate these matters. So, I think ultimately we need more authority over transparency of what these companies coordinate and negotiate with these groups in order to move us towards truly having information that could help avoid these payouts.
And Dorsey?
You know, I think the CEO made a decision that was based on business and the bottom line. And so, you know, that is what he is getting paid to do, and not accepting or owning the role of I'm here to save the world or I'm here to take a principal stance. He made the decision that was best for business. But as someone who spent some time doing some advocacy work with residents on the South End as it relates to, you know, companies that are entangled in fuel by rail and you know, I learned early on that it is a huge public-private bureaucracy, which makes it very difficult for being able to pinpoint who is the decision maker, who is responsible, who should be solving the problem. And so from a business perspective, if I learned that early on, it didn't take me much time to learn that. From a business and profit perspective, I imagine the CEO knew that it was best to put the fire out, because the entanglement of the decisions and where the decisions lie would take a substantial amount of time. And so a few things that I learned, you know, this didn't just happen. So in 2019, there was a formal warning from the Director of Intelligence, you know, really asking leaders in this industry to be mindful, and not just to be mindful, but to put some quality controls in place. And in 2020, the Department of Homeland Security and DOT, Department of Transportation, signed a memorandum to jointly manage and start doing some investigative work into more regulatory policies as it relates to the cybersecurity of pipelines. And so, again, you know, government doesn't have the ability to be as nimble as some of the private industry. And so, you know, while these all sound good, it's going to take some time for government to step in and put the controls in place that are needed. And so given all of that, this CEO knew he needed to act quick and make sure that business could keep moving.
You know, we so often seem to dismiss what corporate executives say, but when he says that he was doing it for the best of the country, that's kind of right, right? I mean, it seems like, yeah, that sort of makes sense. I understand why it's a controversial decision. And it was a controversial decision within the federal government as well as within the ranks of the company. But you can certainly understand the impulse, Alan, of why you would do it in the first place.
Well, yeah. And, of course, we heard from our Jim Endler that it's cheaper, too,
yeah,
than having to do the right thing and, you know, protect yourself.
Also good. We are we're going to take a break. We're going to try to get we figured out how to get
Fran,
thank you very much, Alan. Yeah. I have a very large cast this morning, and I'm blanking on everyone's name. Fran, that's right. Fran Berman will be with us, and we'll get her on the line, and we'll check in with her on this and other issues. We have a wonderful panel this morning. We do welcome your letters. The last call for letters as we go into our final break here. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok is here. Dorsey Appliers, Vera Carius-Kelly, Carolina Gonzalez, and we think maybe Fran Berman. We will get to all of that and much, much more after this short break. Final moments with our great panel this morning. Alan Chartok, Dorsey Appliers, Vera Carius-Kelly. And then, oh, Fran Berman is back. So I'm guessing in the Gilded Age, they don't have the Opal app.
In the Gilded Age, they have no Opal app.
So
thought maybe that was the highlight of the show when I fell off. So.
No, it was far. We were all treading water is what we were doing.
That.
Yes, it was very sad. As
I'm
said,
so
I was like, I set it up for you, you know, that like handing you that question. So what we were talking about is the story about paying the ransom, and everyone has weighed in on it. So what do you make of it?
I would be fascinated to see what everybody said. I mean, this is, you know, a giant challenge of the digital age. And let me just set it up for you, because, you know, it's like saying what happens when something really valuable is taken from you. You know, are you willing to kind of stand by the principle that you, you know, don't benefit the bad guys, or do you want to get it back? And it's the same problem in the digital world that you would have, you know, when the Lindbergh baby was, you know, kidnapped. What would you do? In this situation, it's just a heads up that as these digital technologies become more and more critical infrastructure, so we depend on them for everything we do in life. You know, during the pandemic, we went to school or we went to work. We do it on the radio. You know, we use digital technologies for everything, and as they become critical infrastructure, we really have to think about how we make them safe and secure and private and, you know, okay for us to use and to support benefits for us. In this case, there are some questions, because in cybersecurity incidents, you almost never know, you know, from the public perspective or from the media, what happened. People are very close-mouthed about how it affected them, about what was taken, about, you know, what their infrastructure looked like. As much as I can tell, there wasn't exactly the separation between the operational digital infrastructure and the corporate digital infrastructure. So once they got into the corporate space, a bunch of stuff about how to distribute, all of this stuff and how to bill people and all of that kind of stuff really shut down. So they decided to shut down the pipeline. The decision to pay the ransom got them back up and going quickly. But there are going to be lots more expenses down the line, and all of those expenses, or many of those expenses, will have to do with making the infrastructure really more hacking proof, separating out those different systems, making sure you can't leak from one to another, protecting them in various ways. And one of the things I was happy to see was that the government, who's really stayed on the sidelines a lot of the time in a lot of these digital problems, that Biden said he is going to renew our efforts towards cybersecurity and towards expecting standards from people who are government contractors and making government infrastructure more safe itself. That doesn't mean we're never going to be hacked, but it means that we can at least put some security in place that's stronger, that will help.
Vera made this point, and Jim Henler wrote in while you were gone and said that, you know, paying the
Yay.
Ransom is ultimately, you know, cheaper. And then Vera made the point too that a lot of this falls on the company for being so lax in their security of having a system that allows them to be hacked. I assume that the hackers know that, right? I mean, they know where the weak links are.
It's complicated. First of all, the hackers always have an advantage. They can hack any part of the system. And no matter how much security you put into something, there's always something you didn't think of or some way around. And so, you know, we're always behind the eight ball. And if we're really lucky, we can guard against hacks we've seen, hacks we imagine, but that never covers everything. So that's number one. Number two, the business environment and the whole business model behind most of these companies actually, and that includes us, actually encourage companies to have less cybersecurity. We don't want to wait. We don't want our products to be more expensive. Being able to put in better security, which makes a really different kind of a system, and test it and all of that extra stuff, means that our products, you know, cost more money or might be heavier duty in some way, shape, or form. And so, you know, both the companies who are trying to make a profit out of this and the people who don't want to pay a lot of money for these kinds of things mean that, people put in some security, but not as much as they could. But what we're starting to see in society is all kinds of ways that these things can be intrusive or perhaps dangerous. You know, you can hack a, you know, baby monitor until they fix some of the patches. You could hack a pacemaker or a self-driving car. You can take down a power system. You can do all those kinds of things. And so so for critical infrastructure, for things, you know, on which society depends or on which we will live and die, security should be the topmost priority.
I ask this as a serious question, but what does a hacker gain from hacking a pacemaker? I mean, is it the same thing? Is it ransom? Like, you can live or die?
Or is that just for fun? I mean, hacker communities are really interesting, and people hack for a lot of different reasons. I mean, some people hack for the intellectual challenge of it. Some people hack for some sort of political or national, benefit. Some people hack for money, for ransom. From what I read, and I don't know this, you know, in fact, but from what I read, as they develop cybersecurity scenarios for this, you know, having somebody just come in and ask for ransom was, you know, not really top of the list. And so I think hackers are motivated by a lot of different things. And it's a very secret, you know, environment. If you're a hacker, and there's probably lots of hackers listening in, you know where to go on the internet. You know how to get tools to help you. You know who your people are. And in some sense, this is what complicates it all also, is that sort of governments play into that. There's lots of times we know there are vulnerabilities in products, and we exploit them ourselves to get information, so we don't, say, patch them or encourage the companies to patch them immediately. So it's pretty complicated stuff. If our listeners want a great book to read, this is one of my personal favorites. There's a guy named Bruce Schneier at Harvard who's a cybersecurity expert who writes in a really he's not paying me to do this, who writes in a really accessible way, and he has a great book on cybersecurity called Click Here to Kill Everybody. And it's a great book, and it sort of helps describe just how complicated this environment is.
Alan, you were going to say.
Yeah, very, very quickly. You know, brains count for a lot. The best letter, in my opinion, of the day came earlier at 10:32 saying, pay the ransomware to get Fran back on.
I'm so delighted.
Cost us a lot. We may have to do another day of fundraising just to make that possible.
Yeah, that would be about $2.50 in Bitcoin. But
anyone else would like to comment, Carolina or Dorsey, on this particular subject?
I'm just fascinated by Fran. That's just it.
We all are. Yeah.
I have hours of this. Let's have coffee.
Well, I think it's rarely, you know, you talked about I think we hear about the hacking of, you know, just major infrastructure, but never really thought, never thought about, you know, how it impacts. It could impact the day-to-day. I mean, I also thought about the motivation for hackers being, you know, just to build a reputation, you know? So something as simple as hacking a pacemaker could lead them towards that goal in terms of slowly establishing the reputation of their abilities as well. So this, you know, thank you for that.
Apparently Dick Cheney had a pacemaker, and he disabled the internet access part when he was vice president because he didn't want to be hacked. But if you think about, you know, these modern medical
and let the jokes begin. Go ahead.
Let the jokes begin. I know. But if you think about it, a lot of people have implantable not just pacemakers, but insulin pumps and things like that. And you know, these mechanisms can, you know, send information to your doctor. You can figure out all kinds of things about your body that they want to monitor pretty closely. So it's a great benefit if it's working well and nobody's trying to disrupt it. And then cybersecurity and hacking is all about us trying to disrupt these systems, often for, you know, ill gain.
We do have to go, I'm afraid.
Oh.
I'm sorry. But I thank you all for being with us.
I had such exciting things to say. Though.
Well, I'm sorry. Well, please post them on Facebook. We'll all read them. Thank you all for being with us. Alan, thank you very much. And we'll be back after this.